Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Telling you, bro. What's been happening, bro?
Not too much.
Still hitting them more Peggy-O's?
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to the gorgeous sounds of Mr. Adam Levy, a track called Blueberry Blonde off of his new record, Blueberry Blonde, featuring drummer Jay Bellarose. Finesse, feel, restraint, and taste, that's what I think of when I hear Adam play. He's probably best known for being a member of Norah Jones's band in the late 90s, early 2000s, but he's also done tons of other high-profile gigs. Like playing with Tracy Chapman. Remember Give Me One Reason to Leave Here? Yep, that's him playing the guitar solo on that. Dan Hicks, Amos Lee, bunch of people. But it's his own solo material that's the most inspiring to me. He's not content with putting all of his eggs into the oftentimes tempting and lucrative sideman basket. He's consistently put out all of his own records. I mean, I think he's got 16 solo records, which is amazing now. He also teaches. He's the chair of guitar performance at Los Angeles College of Music. And if that's not enough, he also posts a weekly guitar tips mini lesson on YouTube. We'll talk about all that. In this interview, we play a few tunes. We play some standards. We talk about guitar players, how he hooked up with Norah, note choices, Jim Hall influences, and I really learned a lot on this one, actually, listening back to it. Adam also studied with Ted Green. We didn't get a chance to discuss that, but we talk about Jimmy Weibel, who's another obscure guitar player who he studied with. Adam's got some great ideas, analogies he uses to teach. Gotta admit, it was a late night the night before. I played at the Staples Center Hall & Oates. Woke up sort of groggy. Took an Uber over to Adam's friend Tyler Chester's place called Paper Chaser in Glasspool Park, Los Angeles. Very cool place. Plugged into an old Fender Champ. Adam's plugged into a converted Bell & Howell film projector, now amp. For you audiophiles out there, Adam's guitar is in left and I am in right, so make sure your ear thingies are L&R and you'll be instantly transported to that morning with us. And I hope you enjoy. I was playing the other day, Bluesette. You know Bluesette?
Oh, yeah, sure.
Maybe we could do like a real rubato version of it.
Right, we're in G.
It's nice, right?
That's so nice.
It's such a nice melody. Okay, well. Are we rolling?
Always rolling.
Always rolling. All right. Well. Thank you. Finally got that melody, man. It's hard to. We're like two Starbucks sips in, and I'm trying to play Bluesette in LA at 10 o'clock in the morning. After that's a hell of a change from Staples Center last night.
But that's not on the set list.
No, it's not on the set list. But a really beautiful way to start the day.
Yeah,
you know, it's good to see you, man.
Good to see you.
So I'm sitting here in where are we? We're in LA, but specifically.
This is called Glass Hill Park.
Glass Hill Park.
Yeah. It's kind of the underbelly of Eagle Rock.
Well, I'm here with my friend, old friend, Adam Levy, and assisted skillfully by his friend Tyler in a beautiful studio. Man, what is this studio? I got to give props now because...
It's called Paper Chaser Studio.
Paper Chaser. This will definitely go down as the best sounding episode of Riff Raff. Nothing to do with me. But this is a really hip place, man. Got to take a picture of this place.
Yeah.
But anyway, I want to hear about everything you've been up to, which I know is a lot, man.
It has been a lot. Let's see, where should I start?
Well, we'll tell the listeners how we met. I was telling Tyler, I think we actually met on the phone because you called me one day when you were working with Guitar Player.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Was it Grease Factor? Which record was it?
I think it was some lessons, or maybe I'd done. Okay. You found the lesson.
Right, yeah. So it's all right. So I got kind of grandfathered into being the lessons guy at Guitar Player Magazine. Okay. You can fact check me on this, but this is how I remember it. Now, when you said that really jogged it. So I started writing for Guitar Player as a freelancer in the mid-90s, and then around 96 or something, 97 maybe, they had a kind of a changeover there, and they called me up and they said, "Hey, we might be looking for like a full time lessons guy here at the magazine. Is that something you'd be interested in?" I'd never had any kind of job like that where it was like, you know, 5 days a week, kind of 9 to 5. I'm sure for most people that's normal, but for people like you and me, that's like,
yeah,
what are you talking about?
Every day, 9 to 5.
Really?
Is that?
So. Long story short, I said yes, and then I inherited this file cabinet full of lessons that people had sent in over the years. Not over the years, recently.
Yeah.
Like recent things. It wasn't like they were written on parchment paper in hieroglyphics or something. I think I found your name on a lesson, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I probably had some questions about, you know, the specific stuff of it. And so maybe that's how we started.
That's how we started, and then you moved to New Orleans.
That's right. Yeah. In around 2005, I was touring with Norah Jones, and I knew we were going to have probably a year off between any real substantial work, and I was ready to get out of New York and slow down a little bit. I didn't know how much I'd be slowing down, but I slowed down a lot, and we got to hang out, and that was, yeah, that's when we got to know each other in person.
Man, and even before that, I remember this the other day. I don't know if you remember this, but I remember you calling me once and saying, you were like, hey, man, I got to ask you, I got this situation. I want to see, because I was working with the Neville Brothers, and you were saying, you know, how's it work if, like, they schedule gigs and they cancel the gigs and you've already put them in your book? Like, how would you handle that? Because I'm working with this girl and, you know, I've been doing showcases and I think she's going to make a record and, you know, I'm just trying to deal with the management and, you know, what should I do? Should I ask? You know, I remember you asking me this and then like 6 months later, Norah Jones's record comes out. It was Norah Jones, you know.
Wow.
I don't know if you remember that, but yeah, that turned into that little record.
Yeah.
That little gig you had for a while.
Yeah. It's funny. People will remind me about around that time. When I met Norah, I met her around 2000. And she wasn't signed. She had no management. She hadn't even, when I met her, she hadn't even officially dropped out of, she was going to North Texas studying jazz piano. And when I met her, she was still like planning to get her degree in jazz piano and finish up. So I think when people hear that I played with Norah Jones, they expect that like I auditioned or like maybe my manager played golf with her lawyer or whatever, but it was like totally not like that at all. She was, I don't even think she was 20 yet when I met her. And so even though like you and I are, I think about the same age, you started playing like actual professional, you had way more like real touring experience under your belt. Way before I did. I was kind of a late bloomer. Like the first real gig I had that people would know about, I guess. I mean, I played with Dan Hicks for like a minute in the early 90s.
Dan Hicks and his Hot Licks.
Yeah, he had this side band called Dan Hicks and the Acoustic Warriors, which was a little bit more like a portable thing. Hot Licks was like a big group with these two gals who sang these incredible kind of harmonies, kind of 1940s style harmonies. But that was a big group and a lot of personalities. And so Dan wanted to have this kind of lean and mean group that he could take out. That was just a four piece. And I was part of that for a little while in like 93, 94. So I guess I might have done some gigs that people saw at that time. I know I played at, was that place in New York? That was like the Lone Star or something.
That was before my time, okay. But I've heard of it, of course. Yeah. I heard about it.
Yeah. So I played there with him and with Dan, and I played on Prairie Home Companion, you know, back in the Garrison Keillor days of that show with Dan. So people might have heard me then. But the first gig that maybe was like on the radio that people heard me doing was with Tracy Chapman. And that was like 95. And I didn't stay on that gig really long. And looking back, I've always been a little skittish. But so I did that for like a year in 95.
But wait, you got to interject at a pretty important point. You played the solo on...
Give Me One Reason.
Give Me One Reason. That's you playing that guitar solo.
That's right. So that's me playing Give Me One Reason on Tracy Chapman's record. I played the solo, and it's all live. I mean, that's just like a live in the studio band take. And
where'd you guys cut that?
It was at a place called The Site up in Northern California, kind of near like where George Lucas has all his stuff up there.
Skywalker Ranch.
Yeah, it's like kind of like down the street from Skywalker Ranch. And at that time when we cut that record there, I guess like Pearl Jam had just been in there making, well, I don't know what record would have come out around then, but like a bunch of bands that were big. It was like my first real studio gig. I mean, I was already like almost 30. That's why I'm saying like a bit of a late bloomer. By the time you were 30, I'm sure you had already like been on a bunch of records and been on tour buses and stuff.
A bunch, but I've done some things. Yeah. Yeah. Wouldn't say a bunch.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't really, to me, man, you don't really get seasoned until you get, I don't know if that's true. Cause then look at, I don't know. Forget what I said. Cause you look at Brian Wilson, you have Pet Sounds. This is done. He was like 26.
right. So, but it's different.
It's different for everybody.
It's different for everybody. It's different for everybody. And the thing is, I mean, I was never going to be Brian Wilson, and I am never going to be Brian Wilson, but you know, I wanted to have road chops and experience and stuff. But at the same time, I was always a little bit skittish about going all in as a sideman. You know, even mm-hmm. even though I thought that's what I wanted to do, I would get involved and be like, nah, I don't know, because of stuff with management and all a lot of drama that you don't expect, and then like all of a sudden there's all this drama. So I was with Dan Hicks for about a year, and then I was with Tracy for about a year, and then I was doing some sideman stuff around the Bay Area, but basically was kind of doing my own thing. And then when I met Nora in around 2000, I didn't expect it was going to become what it became. I really thought it was going to be like brunch gigs and, right. you know, because that's how we started. The first gig she called me for was just a little nondescript background music gig. I'm playing standards, really. There's no come away with me or anything like that.
Love me tender, love me sweet, never.
So I'm sure when that stuff started to bubble up, I mean, I thought of you as like, you know, a really professional guitar player who I knew in my circle of friends. And so I'm sure that wasn't the only time I called to ask your advice for stuff.
Cause that's not even what I remember, but we were hanging back then. I remember. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just, that's the stuff that is just, you don't know until you're in situations. Like in music right. school, like they tell you what scales to play, and maybe you take some business classes so you know what like a contract looks like or maybe. And, but like those kind of things where you're having to figure out, you know, what to do when somebody cancels on you, or what to do when you play with a couple of artists and suddenly like their schedules conflict.
Right.
And I guess that's always true, even if you're just playing bar gigs and coffee shops and stuff, but just the stakes are a lot higher when you get to touring, because if you can't make the gig at the coffee shop, it's probably somebody else can. But if you can't make the gig at the Staples Center, that's a lot more complicated.
I always liked the fact that you moved to New Orleans, and I remember you had a solo guitar gig within like a month of living there at the Columns Hotel.
That's,
you know,
right.
You're like, yeah, I'm playing. So it's like, wow, man, that's great. You use a lot of balls to do that. You know, I don't have those kind of balls. So that was really cool. Wow. And I remember we went to Tips one time to hear Sko and
right. Oh, the Uber Jam band,
Uber Jam,
right?
We went
with Adam Deitch.
You hooked it up, actually. We
wow.
went.
Mm-hmm.
We hung out.
Wow. Man, you have an incredible memory.
I remember things like that. I don't remember day-to-day useful bits that I need to know, like times and things like that. But
that's right. Yeah, that was the first time I saw Uber Jam.
Me too.
And might have been, now that I think of it, might have been the first time I ever saw Scofield play live. And, man, I mean, I've been a fan of his since I was, like, 13.
Yeah.
So that was,
wow. I remember talking, you were talking to him, and he's like, yeah, this is Adam Levy, plays with Nora Jones. And I was like, wow, man, Scofield knows who Adam is. Wow. I remember thinking that, like, man, this cat.
Yeah. Sweetie. He told me, he told me a funny story that night about earlier on, I guess he was hanging out in New Orleans. This might have been in the 80s or something, and Albert, he saw that Albert King was going to play at Tips, and Albert King's bus pulls up, and Scofield's so excited because he loves Albert King, and like he just ran to the door, and when the bus door opened, he just like jumped on the bus.
Oh, wow.
And he's like, oh man, Albert, I dig you so much. And like Albert King like pulled a pistol on him. He's like, what do you, get off my bus, I don't know you.
I don't know you.
Yeah. So old school,
man.
You know? Yeah.
The bass player for the Neville Brothers, Nick Daniels, he plays in this band, Dumpster Funk. Man, back in the early 2000s, we're on Sunset Boulevard out here in Hollywood, and we're walking up Sunset towards Guitar Center. Guitar Center's on the far right.
Sure.
And he sees this Porsche is pulled over, and this real tall, skinny dude walks out, and Nick goes, Shane, bro, that's Stanley Clark.
Oh, wow.
That's Stanley Clark, man. And that's like his god. So
right.
Nick just starts running towards
him.
And he goes, Stanley, Stanley, Stanley. So Stanley Clark finally hears him. He turns around. He sees Nick, and he runs in his car and hauls ass. Like, that was the greatest shit ever.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Stanley. Yeah, you know, you got to be careful sometimes. But anyway. You're such a beautiful player, man. And the thing I always liked about your playing is I've never heard you waste a note. Mm. You know, you're like a master of not economy, like in a pretentious kind of thing. I think you really, that's the way you feel stuff, you know? Because some cats will just be like, I'm only going to say the most with one note. I'm like, really? Well, I didn't get anything. You know, but you really have this thing, man, where it's like every note really says something, you know?
Wow. Well, thank you.
How did you, I know you were like a Bill Frisell fan. I remember you turned me on a couple of those records, but
for sure.
Are there any other players, like, I don't know, Jim Hall, those kind of cats you listen to?
Yeah. Well, let's see. I've gone through a bunch of phases of stuff that, I mean, back when I was, when everything was vinyls, and I guess vinyls back again, but when I was younger and that's the only way you could really get stuff. I found Jim Hall somehow. I think before that I was super into Bill Evans, the piano player. Mm-hmm. And so I was like developing my Bill Evans collection. I had all these, LPs from different eras of Bill Evans. And I stumbled onto Jim Hall really because he had made a record with Bill Evans called Undercurrent. Mm. It's just the two of them. And there's this version of My Funny Valentine that everybody always plays as a ballad. It is a ballad. And they do this just blazing up-tempo thing that where you really feel the time, even though there's no rhythm section on the record. It's just piano and guitar.
Wow, I've never heard that. I'll have to check it out.
You should check it out. And it's so cooking. And so that was probably the first Jim Hall record that I heard. And then I didn't do the deep dive for a while, but probably the next record I got into was... was probably the Sonny Rollins record, The Bridge.
Oh, yeah.
But his playing on those two records is pretty different, especially... Well, the thing about Jim Hall, right, is like people always talk about the lyricism and the use of space and also like development. Like if he plays an idea, even if it's not the best idea, he'll work it to death. Like he'll make a beautiful suit out of a pretty average piece of fabric. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, I mean, sometimes he comes up with beautiful pieces of fabric too. But I think the thing that struck me is like when you listen to some, you know, not so great players, if they play an idea that doesn't knock you out or knock themselves out, they'll like abandon it immediately and just try to find something else that's just like cooler. That's just really from their skill set, from their lick bag. And Jim Hall would like play something and in the moment you go like, okay, that's interesting, I wonder what he's going to do next. And instead of like, you know, dipping into his trick bag, he's like, okay, here's a really average thing. He's like, he went to the grocery store and they didn't have really choice cuts of meat or any beautiful vegetables, and somehow he makes this beautiful meal out of kind of just normal run-of-the-mill things. And so that's the thing that struck me about him. But also people talk about his lyricism, but man, he could really burn sometimes. You know, he really played legato like that. So My Funny Valentine is an example of his really up-tempo playing. And there's a tune on that Sonny Rollins record, The Bridge, that I can't think of right now, but it's pretty up-tempo. It might be called, it's either the song The Bridge or it might be the song John S. It starts out with like, this funny da 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 da. You just listen to it and you're like, wow, what's happening here? I never heard anything like it. I got it when I was a teenager, and all of a sudden the rhythm section kicks in and it's so fast, and the way that he could play at fast tempos was really inspiring to me because I never could figure out how to like really play fast as far as like down up picking. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid and like into rock and I guess fusion-y stuff, I would see somebody like Steve Morse, who I saw play many times. I was like, I have no idea how anybody could ever do that,
yeah,
even if you practice all the time.
Extreme, yeah.
And then I got to see Holdsworth. And growing up in L.A., like, everybody would come through. So there was this club called the Country Club in Reseda. And it was all ages. So I could go see shows when I was, like, 16 there. So I saw IOU, you know, Holdsworth. Yeah.
Did he have the singer with the, like, the little polo shirt with the tiger on it? Remember that video,
Japanese video? Yeah. if he had it, I've blocked it from my memory.
His name's Paul Williams, I think.
Yeah, it is Paul Williams. Yeah, if he had Paul Williams, it's blocked from my memory. I remember it being an instrumental gig. But I saw the Steve Morse band there when his first solo record came out, and I saw IOU. And so I like those are two really extreme different guys from the kind of rock to fusion thing, like, Steve Morse picks everything, and Alan Holdsworth picks nothing.
Yeah.
And then I heard Jim Hall, and it kind of spoke to me because it wasn't all legato, and it wasn't all picking, but he found a way to really make the guitar swing by picking some things and slurring some things. And so that really grabbed me. And then other guys that I've loved, I mean, just to your point about trying to not do it with too many notes, but also not to be overly precious and like, here's my one perfect note.
Right.
I hate that shit too. I remember I took a lesson with this guy, Jeff Richmond. Did you ever meet Jeff?
I know who he is, sure. Yeah, he lives out here, right?
Yeah, he lives here. Like, so this is when I was like probably 18 or 19, and I was already going to music school. I was going to Dick Grove and learning all the mechanics of the guitar. And he's like, hey, have you ever checked out Chet Baker? And I was like, no. Does he play guitar? He's like, no, he doesn't play guitar. He's a trumpet player. And so he pointed me, funny enough, to a Jim Hall record that Chet Baker played on. Mm. There's a Jim Hall record called Concierto. And I know I'm going to blank out on the tune, but Chet Baker's on there and Paul Desmond is on there. And his Chet Baker solo was what Jeff Richmond assigned me to learn. Maybe he had a transcription or I had to transcribe it myself. I don't remember. But it was really eye-opening. Like, Chet Baker's thing is so melodic. And that thing, like, the old guys always say about, like, if you're going to play standards, learn the melody. It's like when you hear somebody who's 60 say that and you're 18, you think, like, thanks, Grandpa. You know, I'm just going to learn this other stuff that you're supposed to play.
But it's so true, man.
But it's so true. And Chet Baker, like, was perfect example of that. Like, and even though I didn't ever meet Chet Baker, and if I did, that's probably wouldn't be what he said, but that's what he said to me through that solo. When I listened to it, I was like, oh yeah, the melody. I was thinking about this the other day. Do you remember those posters that were really popular like 20 years ago that just looked like a bunch of psychedelic dots, and if you stare at it long enough, all of a sudden there's like this 3D thing, like, oh, it's a dolphin.
And McLaughlin did a cover on one of his records. Remember John McLaughlin? Yeah, there's one of his solo records has. It's called Now You See It, Now You Don't, and it's like that thing you're talking about.
Wow. No, I got to check that out. And I feel like the melodies of standard tunes are kind of like that. When you're young and you hear these melodies, you kind of go like, yeah, whatever, man. It's just a bunch of dots, you know. But like, if you stare at it long enough, all of a sudden this other thing is like the shape of the tune is the melody is the shape of the tune. It's not the changes. It's not anything else. It's that. But you don't get it at first. You have to like relax into it and just kind of like look at it. Yeah.
Guitar tips thing is very hip. And you talk about these sort of subjects, and I like the way you condense these sort of things into little YouTube clips. I mean, it's a gold mine for people wanting to, you know, be able to pick your brain. I mean, that's like, we didn't have stuff like that. We were learning, you know, somebody like Adam Levy or somebody telling you stuff for free every week.
Yeah.
You know, and what gave you the idea for that?
That's a good question.
And sorry to interrupt, but Guitar Tips, I'm sure if you've tuned in, you know, because Adam, but he posts, was it every week? He posts
every week,
a guitar tip, a subject, and you talk, 5-10 minutes, and it's always some useful thing, and you demonstrate. And the unique thing about it is you have your own little theme song, and you always do a different version or reharm. It's really cool. Yeah, so check that out if you don't already know about it. But yeah, so sorry. So what gave you the idea, though?
So when I first moved back to LA, so I can't remember if we did the whole geography thing, but I've moved around a bunch. Like, so after we met in New Orleans and hung in New Orleans, I moved back to New York for a little while and yada yada. And then about 4 or 5 years ago, I moved back to LA. And when I first moved back here, I wasn't doing anything. I still had a really good paying gig in New York. So like for the first 9 or 10 months I was living in LA, I was barely here. I was just always at the airport flying back and doing gigs and whatever. And after almost a year of that, I was like, you know what, if I'm going to live in LA, I have to really root down and actually let go of things in New York and be here, be on the scene, go out to hear live music, meet people, do stuff. And in the meantime, the phone wasn't ringing that much, and I didn't have a Collins Hotel gig to go to on Sundays. And I was just really looking for a project. And I read this book about, wealth. I was trying to figure out how to be wealthy. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that he advised in the book, the author, was like, do something on a regular basis. I don't know if he said every week, but do something on a regular basis for your community for free. And I couldn't quite figure out how that was going to manifest as any kind of wealth, but it seemed like a cool thing to do. And I already did know the value of doing a weekly thing from doing weekly solo gigs. I had a weekly solo gig when I lived in San Francisco. I had a weekly solo gig when I lived in New Orleans. There's that thing of this unbreakable chain where, like, every week you do this thing, and if you look at your calendar and you make a mark on it, there's this like unbreakable chain. Some people do something every day. Oh, I'm going to do my exercise routine every day, or I'm going to eat this particular diet or whatever. So I knew that there was power in having an unbroken chain of things. And since I wasn't working that much and I wasn't even really teaching that much, I was kind of like hiding in plain sight in LA. I thought, I know what I could do. I could make instructional, just little bits. I was also inspired. Jim Campolongo, actually, for a little while, had a column in maybe Premier Guitar, I forget, where he was doing a lot of guitar tips. And this is a long answer, but also I remember there was that Mick Goodrick book, The Advancing Guitarist. Mm-hmm. Did you read that
book? Sure,
So there's all the kind of meat and potatoes stuff, but then at the back, just like the last 4 or 5 pages are just
that's really a lifetime of stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
So there was just all these little short things, like 2 or 3 sentences that like really stick with you about, you know, not regretting things and just really cool philosophical ideas about playing and being a musician with your life, and all really condensed into little things. So somewhere between Jim Campolongo's like practical tips, like, hey, when you come home after the gig, don't put your guitar in the case in the corner. Take it out, put it on a stand. So tomorrow when you wake up, the guitar is just there looking at you. Mm. Like, don't hide it from yourself. Like, even if you live in a crappy little New York apartment that's 200 square feet, don't tuck your guitar under the bed. When you get home, so that was like a really practical thing. And then Mick Goodrick's things were like really philosophical. So between those two guys and this, and my own experience, and between what I read in this book, all of that sort of manifested as guitar tips. So I did one, and I didn't promote it. Like, at that point, I wasn't even on Facebook or any other social media. I wasn't trying to promote anything or sell anything. I just was like, it's almost like a practice for me to be able to pick my own brain. What did I wish somebody had told me when I was trying to figure this stuff out? And try and be concise. You know, people aren't going to watch a 2-hour YouTube video mm-hmm. about whatever. But they might watch something that's 5 or 10, or if it's interesting, maybe even 15 minutes. And then the theme song thing, that was just to amuse myself. I started out doing it kind of the same every week. And then little by little, I was like, oh, what if I do one that's like based on this Barney Kessel jazz thing? Or what if I do one that's based on the Rumble by Link Wray? Or what if I do a Zeppelin tune and just have some fun? It's to tickle myself, really, to be honest.
Guitar tips, just the tips, just for you. Guitar tips.
Hello and welcome to Guitar Tips. My name is Adam Levy. I'm your host here.
You know, you made me think of something. Didn't you tell me your grandfather wrote Gilligan's Island theme?
That's right.
Well, there you go. It's in your DNA, man. That's, I don't know if you've ever said that before, but that's a pretty cool thing.
Yeah.
Everybody knows that, that tune.
Man, if, yeah, I never thought of it that way. See, when I started doing the Guitar Tips theme, I didn't think of it as a theme song. I, again, my only hope was to challenge myself to not have it be the same thing every week. Just mm-hmm. like, again, kind of almost a gag to tickle myself. And, but over, you know, what I've been doing it for like 3 years now, it has become a theme and it is in my DNA. Yeah. My grandfather wrote the theme song. He wrote the musical part to the Gilligan's Island theme song.
Mm-hmm.
So it's in, yeah, it's in there.
Play something else?
Sure.
It feels like we both have, well, you're playing a Gibson 335.
Right.
And I pulled something. I like got off stage and I said, man, I have to go see Adam tomorrow. So I just told my guitar tech, pack up a guitar. So that's the wrong gig. So I have like this old 330 that's in a totally wrong gig bag with no padding.
Right. It's when I saw the case, so the since people can't see this, it's like, you know, a $39 gig bag that has some tape on it on the outside. This is Terrio Takamine.
Actually, it says John Oates Takamine.
Oh, John Oates Takamine.
Yeah, so, I just noticed that. Yeah, I was like, the wrong bag.
Okay, Shane, so you brought John Oates Takamine. I won't tell him. But here you pull this guitar out of the bag, and it's this gorgeous, I don't know, 58, 59.
It's a 59, yeah. I kind of rescued this thing, man. It was battered. And
oh, man, it's but, incredible looking. Wow.
Yeah, it's just I spent way too much money fixing it. I could have just bought one, but whatever.
Yeah.
But anyway, I was going to say, if you want to play something, it feels...
Sure.
Since we're playing these, man, it feels jazzy to me.
Yeah.
I don't know.
You want
to play another... We could play another tune.
Yeah, let's do it.
I can try to embarrass myself on my own podcast with Adam. You know, go ahead.
I was wondering if you were going to go for it. That's
there.
Cool. I totally forgot about that. That's the real ending.
Yeah.
It doesn't do that on the intro, does it?
No, I don't think
it's
so.
It's like one of five jazz standards I know, kind of. But
no, man, you play so great.
Oh,
I actually haven't heard you play much straight ahead.
I don't play straight ahead, man.
Yeah, it's not true. The evidence is there.
I mean,
hit rewind.
Used to, but yeah.
It's all there.
Lesson the other day in New York. I haven't done that in 25 years, but wow. I'm sure he's a friend of yours, Adam Rogers.
Oh,
because my right hand technique, I kind of screwed it up a couple of years ago, I was telling Sko about it, because I tried to go back to like index and middle and get, you know, so I could get that kind of pick every note thing.
Yeah.
But then in the meantime, when I'm like doing my actual gigs that I do to make money, you know, I can't do that on stage or a session. So it really messed up everything, man. And like told me to play just long notes.
Oh, wow.
Really long notes, like to where it's painful to get through one scale.
Mm-hmm.
And it's so weird, but it actually helps me out a lot with like just playing. Everything's more even now.
Huh.
Because I didn't have shitty technique, but it's just a different thing. It's kind of like going to a chiropractor.
Right.
That's kind of why I went to do it. But anyway, we were playing a bunch of tunes, and sit with somebody like him, and all right, that rhythm changes, you know. And then you're like going, ooh, you know. So it's fun.
Wow. Yeah, I just got his new record, Dice. Have you heard that?
He gave it to me. Yeah, I've been listening to it. It's cool.
Oh, man.
It's like Hendrix on like that went to school or something.
Yeah, exactly. It's a trip because I always think of Adam Rogers as a 335 guy. And I'm sure he's played Strat on a bunch of sessions and stuff, but I don't think of him as a Strat guy. So it's interesting, and it's like it's so New York, like,
yeah, it's very New York.
You know, Wayne and Laney, mm-hmm. and like New York guitar trio, like you play mm-hmm. Strats. It's funny. I never grew up with them. Every couple of years I get a wild hair to like figure it out. I grew up in LA in a time when like the Kings were Larry Carlton and Lee Ritenour,
yeah.
and they were all these kind of like session guys who were also, you know, artists and record covers. They always had 335s, and they got into B.B. King, and he always had some kind of Gibson. And the only Strats you'd see around L.A. when I was growing up weren't even Strats. They were like these Valley Arts kind of overbuilt things with Floyd Rose tremolos mm-hmm. and EMGs and
fancy active, headstocks.
Fancy headstocks, gold, a lot of gold plating. Really overbuilt. And like now, I think what's cool about Strats is if you can find one that doesn't weigh a ton and just breathes, you know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not enough of a Strat guy, but of course now you go around LA and there's like you got Mike Landau, who's like maybe the Strat guy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's no shortage of them now, but I never learned how to play them. I got a 335 from my dad when I was 13 for my bar mitzvah. He's lucky me. He said, you know, what do you want to get? You know, I was already really serious. He's like, I'd love to support you. What?
Wow, that's really nice.
Yeah, man. And at 12 and a half, it's funny looking back, most 12 and a half year olds wouldn't choose. If you could go to Guitar Center and just like pick something off the wall, you probably wouldn't pick
Kramer Pacer or the Floyd Rose. Yngwie Scallop neck.
Yeah, no. I picked what has become my voice, but it was really. Actually, I was studying for a little bit with this guy, Jimmy Weibel.
Sure, man. I don't know him, but I remembered learning some of his. Those kind of.
Oh, yeah.
Woo! You know, the 2/5s and all that. Yeah. I had a bunch of his etudes and stuff. Yeah, I know who he is.
So he was you mentioned my grandfather who wrote the Gilligan's Island theme song. So he worked in TV a lot. He didn't just sit around writing theme songs. He actually, like, was a band leader and arranger and worked on a lot of TV shows that had live bands because you mm-hmm. did back then. So he was the musical director on this show, the Flip Wilson Show.
People can
check it out.
Sure.
YouTube or whatever. And he always hired Jimmy Weibel was his guy because Jimmy Weibel could read anything. Like you could literally give him like a piano part or a full score and he would look at it and he would turn it into guitar music instantly. So my grandfather was like, that's the guy I'm going to hire because, you know, my grandfather was a legit musician and, you know, guitar players kind of have a reputation for not being great readers or whatever. Jimmy Weibel was, besides being a really creative artist, was just super legit. You could put anything in front of him and he could read it. He was that guy. So when I was 12, my grandfather asked Jimmy if he could maybe give me a couple lessons. And I was 12. Like, all I knew how to play was Beatles songs. And he was teaching me those etudes.
Yeah,
and I was like,
that's fun when you're 12.
Yeah, I was like, can't we just learn, like, you know, Nowhere
Revolver
Man or something? Yeah, Revolver. Yeah. So anyway, what was my... Oh, shoot. I was going somewhere with mentioning Jimmy. Oh, I asked, I didn't have a good guitar yet. I just had this like crappy nylon string guitar. And I asked Jimmy what I should get. And he's like, well, you want to be a studio musician when you grow up? And I was like, yeah. He's like, you should try and get an ES-335 because you can really do anything with it. You can play rock, jazz, country, blues, whatever. And so that, as much as, you know, anything, that really informed me. And I remember I wrote to Norlin Industries, who at that time owned Gibson. I must have seen it in the back of Guitar Player. And so I wrote away, and they sent me a catalog. I wish had it. I had the 1979 Norlin Industries Gibson catalog with all these, you know, sexy... I mean, to me, this was like my first porn magazine was the Gibson catalog. Yeah. And I looked at those pictures over and over. And so I decided I really wanted ES-335 TD in this dark walnut finish. And sure enough, can I swear?
Yeah, hell, okay. Shit, yeah.
Okay, rock, sure as shit, my dad came through, and on my bar mitzvah, I had a brand new 1979 ES-335 and a little Princeton amp with no reverb. And that was my rig for a long, you know, until I got my first, you know, MXR Distortion Plus or something.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. Do you have that guitar still?
I still have that guitar.
That's good. That's the good ending to it, because I was hoping you still had that.
It's not the one I'm holding today in my hands, but that's the guitar on Give Me One Reason.
Oh.
It's that guitar. That's the guitar that I played on most of the first Nora record. And it's the only guitar I had for a long time.
That's a very New York thing, man, have one guitar. I wish I could just have one guitar.
Yeah.
It's hard, though, when you juggle gigs and things. But I think that's the only thing I've ever seen you play was a 335.
Yeah, that's pretty much it. Over the years, I've dabbled in Telecasters and Strats.
That's right, Telecaster.
But every time I do, it's just people always ask me, like, hey, man, where's your guitar? So... yeah, it's pretty much what I'm into. But yeah, do you know that guy Nir Felder in New York?
Sure, I don't know him well, but I've met him a few times. Yeah.
He's a one guitar guy. He's got this.
He's
like,
got that Squire Strat Strat.
He's got a Mexican Strat that he got probably when he was in high school, probably because of, I don't know, whoever, Stevie Ray Vaughan or something.
Yeah,
and he just stuck to his guns. And yeah, that's super.
It's
New
funny
York.
He came. It's funny, man, that you're saying that, because Nir came up to me at 55 Bar. I'd never met him, and he came. He goes, "You're Shane. Man, I used to read your guitar column. You know, I saw a couple of your lessons when I was like 14. And I'm going, oh, thanks, man.
How do you feel when people say that kind of stuff?
Oh, they didn't. That's like the only time anybody's ever said that. You mean like, what, like getting older or something?
Yeah, because I know, like, I've met some artists, like, not so much guys our age, but guys like maybe a little bit older, where when you say stuff like that, like, oh man, I've been listening to you since I was 14, they kind of bristle at it. And to me, it's like...
Well, how old are you now?
I was born in 66, so...
Okay, yeah, you're a few years older than me.
Yeah.
6 years older than me. But, I don't know, man. I take it as a compliment, I guess. You know, as long as anybody's listening, period, it's good. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. The thing that I get a lot is I used to teach guitar at this thing called the National Guitar Workshop, which happened, there was two campuses, there was East Coast and West Coast. And that was a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And I get guys coming up to me pretty regularly now in LA and around who are like, oh man, you won't remember me, but I was at the National Guitar Workshop when I was 14 and I was in your class. But a lot of those guys now are like, professional, like,
yeah,
they're the guys who are playing all the gigs now.
Right.
I mean, that's how I met Rich Hinman. I met him when he was at Guitar Camp, and he's out on the road now with Katie Lang, and he and I have a band together in L.A. He's toured with Sarah Bareilles. He's on a bunch of records. Zane Carney and Reeve Carney, both of those guys went to this Guitar Camp. I think Brian Green went there, who's a really great LA session guy now. Like, he toured with John Legend and like all these the guys who are like between 30 and 40 now. Mm-hmm. Tons of them 15 years ago went to this guitar camp, and so I love it when people say like, "Oh, you know," but I was like 14, because I still in somewhere in my heart am 14. You know, and I like that's the part of me that's most excited about guitar.
Oh man,
like that
absolutely! I was saying the other night, I want to be, the feeling when you're 14 and I was in junior high and I couldn't wait to get home and like just take my guitar out of the case and play my Van Halen lick or whatever Wes Montgomery thing I learned over and over. It was like, it felt so good. Yeah. I want to be able to tap into that shit all the time.
All
like
the time.
Get it, even though it's Staples Center and whatever. It's like, I want to be able to get that. And it's not always there anymore.
Yeah.
Because once you become proficient and you do it as quote living, you know. And it's funny, man, like the I see now, like a couple of days ago I had a lunch with my guitar instructor from MI when I was here. Dan Gilbert is a great unsung hero, and Alan Hines, who, you know, these cats are like, they were older. They're older than me, and when I was here I looked up to them, like,
sure.
And now we're like kind of peers, you know. We go to lunch and it's kind of a weird thing because you're or Scott Henderson, you know.
Yeah.
Like, these are cats you look up to, and at some point you go, well, you kind of, I don't know if graduate is the right word, but you're in the club now. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so that's what you're talking about. I mean, those were your students, man.
Yeah.
And you must have done a great job. They're all happening.
Well, I'm glad that when they come up to me, most of them anyway are guitar players. It's not like I'm at Denny's and the guy comes and brings me my omelet and he goes like, "Hey man, you won't." It's always in professionals.
You got about that. Yeah.
It's really like, you know,
you won't remember me, but hey, is that unleaded or regular? I forget. You want?
No, it's never that. It's always like some dude who's on his way to a session,
yeah.
Or it's at the airport. Some guy's on tour. I say guys, it's gals too. It's just like, it's been a cool thing to see how many of those young guitar players got serious and hung at it. And that's really like the only difference, and I'm not the first person to say this, but it's true. The only difference between a professional musician and a non-professional musician is that you just don't stop. That's it.
Don't piss anybody off, or don't piss too many people off, and don't stop. Because, you know, you never know, man, when you're coming up. I have a friend in New York who used to own a jingle studio.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, he was like a lowly intern getting coffee and stuff.
Sure.
And he told me, he's like, man, there were certain guys that would come in that you know, like name cats, and they treated me like a piece of dirt.
Right.
And there were cats that treated me like an equal, and they were cool. Like, he goes, man, I'll tell you two off the top of my head, Michael Brecker and Will Lee. They always came in and they were nice as could be to me, and they were genuine. And he goes, guess what? When I had a jingle studio and I had budgets, who would I call? Not because they could play their ass off, but they were cool.
Right.
You know, I've had people treat me like shit. And then when I started getting good gigs or like in clicks with sessions, they call me, hey, man, how come you don't? And it's like, well, I mean, we never really hung. And you were kind of a prick to me back when. Like, why would I?
Right.
I thought you didn't give me the time of day. Like,
right.
You know, that's unfortunately, I think that's in any profession, but it's especially evident in what we do because it's such a, you mix in ego with it.
Yeah.
It's a prescription for, anyway.
Yeah.
I'm going off here. I want to ask you something to totally break the chain here.
Okay.
You remember when you played at Sanger Theater with Nora Jones?
Mm-hmm.
Probably not, but I wasn't in town, but you graciously got me a couple tickets for my wife.
Okay.
And she said, I don't know if this is true.
Whoa.
She said, wow, the concert was awesome, but right in the middle of the concert, I guess Nora Jones was playing like a solo or something, and a giant roach went across the stage. And she stopped and like said something about it. That's,
wow. That does ring a bell, actually. That really does ring a bell. And it probably, in retrospect, would have been like a water bug or not a...
Well, that's a polite way of saying it. It's a roach.
I guess so.
A palmetto bug.
It's a palmetto.
It's a roach. And it's giant. And
that sounds about right.
But one of the biggest roaches I've ever seen is here in L.A. when I lived in Hollywood. Man, this thing was like a frigging animal. It was on top of the toilet, and I took a plastic Ralph's bag, and it wasn't a crappy apartment if you're visualizing like a crib. It was a decent apartment.
Right.
And I bagged this thing. My roommate's like, man, you gotta bag it. So I took Ralph's bag, and I could feel it like punching the bag.
Oh, wow.
I don't know why I talk about this. I don't like roaches and things like that.
Well, man, we're just, you know, the earth, we're not the only creatures on the earth, and we have to deal. I mean, I live really close to here, where we are right now in Glassell Park, and we get all manner of crawling things around, and we get coyotes and raccoons.
Those pesky animals. We need to
skunks and yeah. But it's like that's
it's like Dr. John says. He's like, hey, they got a right to life just as much as you and me. It's
true
like,
story.
That's true, Mac. But you also eat, you know, raccoons. And
yeah.
Anyway, well, what else you want to talk about, man? How long have we been gone? Anything else you want to talk about,
man? I just have a question for you, and this has plagued me. This is probably something I've asked you before, but and you've even talked about it in a book, but like two or three years ago, well, less than 2 years ago, I got to play with Alan Toussaint, mm-hmm. my one and only time in my life. He was making the record that became his last record. He actually passed away before it came out. It's called American Tunes. And I got to just play on. They had mostly finished the record, and they had one day, they'd booked the studios. There was like a day left. So the producer called me. He's like, hey, we're doing some kind of bits and pieces. Do you want to come play a song with Alan Toussaint? And I was like, yes.
Yeah, right.
Drop whatever I'm doing that day. Drop everything. So it was Paul Simon's song, American Tune. And so I learned to play it, and I wound up playing it. And it was amazing. I got to track live with Alan mm-hmm. singing. And he was so full of life, and I don't think anybody in the room thought it was like 6 weeks later that he passed or something.
Man, it's
so crazy.
Mm-hmm.
He said, actually, when he was on his after I recorded with him, we all sat and listened to the whole record top to bottom, and he packed up his little valise. He's like, "All right, I'll see you at the Vanguard," because the last time he made a record, they did a week at the Vanguard.
Many is the time I've been mistaken, and many times confused. Yes, and I've often felt forsaken, and certainly misused. Oh, but I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm just weary.
But anyway, when I first walked in, he was just warming up on the piano, and he was playing Big Chief. Mm-hmm. And like my dream, can I play Big Chief on the guitar?
I've heard it done. I mean, I can't do it.
I was going to say, if any human being can do it,
I've never tried
to
do it, but I've heard it done. But but Alan did a nice version of Big Chief. And it's funny, I got to record with him once on a Jesse Winchester tribute record. And it was a similar experience. I went in with a nylon string guitar, and it was just he and I, and we tracked live. And it was really like, you know, I forget. It was like, but it was simple, but this, you know, the finger squeaks and everything's a live mic. And Alan wanted to do the vocal live and everything, so we spent like 3 hours doing this thing. And he was like, well, I mean, you know how he was very articulate, and and he's like, well, I mean, they're talking about the water, so I need to change my phrase. I'm sorry, let's try it again.
Oh,
so I
wow.
played it like pretty good for about 20 times in a row, and then I screwed up, and he stops and he goes, it's about time you make a mistake. But we ended up doing that track, and that was my memory with Alan, and we played a couple gigs after. But anyway, Big Chief, man, I've heard it done. I could do if I sat and... Ooh, something like that. I don't know, but I could figure it out. I've somebody's done it before, but it's like an augmented thing, right?
Yeah.
But Big Chief is in E, so that would be a B flat.
Right.
Let's see. Something like that. So I don't know, but you could do it,
man.
I'd probably sit and figure it out.
Next time I see you, maybe when I come to New York next month, I'll see if I can get a lesson,
and
we can spend an hour just working on that together, because
yeah.
I can't even groove.
Yeah, we'll work on it. We'll do it another time.
Okay. Around that time when I got to spend a couple hours with him, like, I went home just thinking, like, I'm going to throw away all my guitar records and just try to learn as much of his piano style and just the more broadly, like, the New Orleans piano style. Like, that's, like, the next thing that I want to just sit and tackle. It's just, how can I turn my guitar into a New Orleans piano?
Yeah, well, John Cleary's great, man. Check him out.
Okay.
You know, but I don't know, anything else? Do you want to talk about?
No, man, I feel like we covered
the big chief question. I don't know if I answered that correctly, but
well, I learned something. You can play one more tune if you want to.
Yeah, why don't you start something, man? Anything you want. We can get out of our jazz brunch hour if you want.
Okay.
Anything, I don't care.
Tyler, do you have any requests?
Sing one.
Oh, wow, that's an idea. I could sing one.
Sure, go ahead.
Okay. Now we're talking. Okay, if I sing one, you want to just wing it? I can teach it to you, or you want to just do it?
Let's just do it.
Okay.
I may regret this, but...
Well, you can edit it out if you don't like it. The luxury. It's your
shit,
show.
You've got the raga tuning.
Double check it so it's honest enough.
I see your flying eagle, and you know David Torkanowski in New Orleans.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Yeah, he's got the most colorful phrases, man. And I remember we finished his session one time, and producer goes, "Well, thanks, guys, man. And that was great, and everything." And Tork goes, "Yeah, I was wondering if we could discuss the methodology of the eagle flying." Meaning, like, get paid.
Oh, you know? That's funny. Man. The other night, I was at, I want to use this. I haven't figured out what to do with it yet, but I was talking with, do you know Anna Butters, Tyler?
Who?
Anna Butters. She plays bass at the ETA gig with Jay and Jeff Parker. Anyway, she's great. She's an upright bass player. She's from Australia. And I was talking to her, and somebody else came up, and he's like, "Oh, do I detect an accent?" She's like, "Yeah, I have an accent." And he's like, "Oh, are you from England?" She's like, "No." He's like, "Australia?" She's like, "Yep." She must get this all the time. Mm-hmm. This all the time. And she's like, "Yeah, it's okay. It's all, you know, part of the Commonwealth." I was like, "Commonwealth?" I didn't even know what that meant. And she's like... she's describing what the Commonwealth is. I'm like, "Oh," I said, "is there a queen on your money?" She's like, "Yeah." So I want to write a tune or something called Queen on the Money.
Queen on the Money. That's great.
Because it could mean anything, but, you know, I like phrases like that where, like, in the moment, it's specifically it's Commonwealth if there's queen on your money. But Queen on the Money could just be anything.
It could
cool.
be anything.
Yeah.
I like going to, you know, Europe and Japan where they have cool people on their money. Cool-looking people.
Cool, like people who create stuff.
Yeah, old-looking people.
Yeah, not just like good old boys club of, you know.
One of my favorite David Letterman things where he said top 10 things Abe Lincoln would say if he were alive today. And I'm not much of a Letterman fan of the latter shows, but that was some funny shit. And it was like, number one, "Hey, babe, that's me on the $5 bill."
That's awesome.
Okay, well, what is this, man? So,
we're in D. It's called This Is Our House.
Okay.
And I'll sing a couple verses, and you want to take a solo, and then I'll... out of the solo goes to the four, to the bridge. So that's the only information you probably need to know.
Some inflammation.
(clears throat) This is our house, three little rooms. Ain't too bad when the flowers are in bloom. Don't get much sun, don't get much shade, but this is our house, we got it made. This is our child, the apple from our tree. She looks like you, she talks like me. Someday she'll lead the band in a honky-tonk parade. This is our family, we got it made. I've told the story true, I haven't strayed. There are no riches for which I trade. This is our house, we've got it made. This is our house, we've got it made. This is our house, we've got it made.
Yeah, Adam. Man, I don't think there's anything left to say after that. Yeah. That's a. Why don't we end on a high point?
All right.
Well, thanks so much, man, for doing this. It's great seeing you.
Thanks, yeah. Shane. It's a pleasure.
This mic is lower, so I'm like talking. But no, seriously, thank you. And thank you, Tyler, and, you know, for the great sound that I'm sure this is going to end up being. Great sounding. And, yeah, bro, hopefully it's not, I don't know, years before we hang again.
Yeah. Let's make a point of it.
All right. Well, thanks. See you next time. All right, if you're still listening, thanks for hanging in there. Enjoyed that episode with Adam. As always, I love your comments. Been getting a lot of comments, actually. Got some great shows coming up. Have Tommy Malone from the Sub Dudes, David Grissom. Let's see, I don't know, some other people. I did get some emails, not nasty emails, but concerning my Madeleine Peru episode where we talked about France. No, I don't hate France. I love France. It's actually in my blood. It was just that particular trip was a little tiring. I think it was something about air conditioning or something. I didn't want to turn the air conditioning on. It was hot as shit. So maybe that's why France came up, but no. Love France. My 2, 3, 4 French listeners. Love you guys. Don't stop listening. And, yeah, the iTunes reviews definitely help me out. If you have any questions, feel free to email. I'll try to keep these going as long as you guys respond. All right. Take care. Thanks for listening.
Save big money now on new siding from LP SmartSide at Menards. Update and beautify your home with your choice of 13 timeless colors of pre-finished engineered siding. It's durable and includes a Sherwin-Williams factory finish paint warranty that means no painting for years to come. View our entire selection of siding from LP SmartSide today. And don't forget to check out our flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save